Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. And today on the show,
we found in the study that only about half of the workers who knew or thought they might have been underpaid or otherwise exploited went to those agencies or to their unions.
A new report shows some young workers are being underpaid. We have all the details. Also, a new report shows how Victorian forests are doing after banning the native forest logging. And later today,
Northern Territory Emergency Service started in early January after Cyclone Tracy in January 1975. So there was a civil defence and then came across to Northern Territory Emergency Service and quite active in that Tennant Creek area.
NT Emergency Services is 50 years young and will bring the community together to learn more about this vital service. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Thanks for being with us today. We're net across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up today, the community services sector in Tasmania is urging the incoming government to prioritise the needs of people and not just the interests of the AFL. A coalition of 16 non-government organisations have welcomed commitments from the three major parties to establish a partnership with the community sector after Saturday's election. The Tasmanian Council of Social Service CEO Adrian Piccone says the government cannot ignore the cost of living crisis facing thousands of Tasmanians. Here's political reporter from CRN Noah Seckham speaking with Ms. Piccone.
When I'm speaking with ACOS broadly about what the federal government needs to do, it's always about stepping in and increasing welfare. When we're looking at Tasmania, what are the things that you're calling for, especially in this state election?
Yeah, look, Tasmanians are really experiencing a cost of living crisis at the moment. The Tasmanians that we talk to tell us that they're really worried about being able to pay their rent, to put food on the table, to pay their electricity bills or pay their healthcare bills. So we're really hearing that there's a lot of pain out there for Tasmanians. And what this does is it increases the demand on community services. And this comes at a time when we're not receiving adequate resourcing or investment. So really what we're about today is to ask the incoming government to prioritise all Tasmanians and really hear about the pain that they're experiencing and invest adequately in community services.
The big uphill battle seems to be getting people's issues heard and the needs of the community over, the big ticket item like the stadium, which has really dominated the discussion. How disappointing is it that that's what we're talking about instead of the community concerns?
Yeah, look, the stadium has absolutely dominated the debate here in Tasmania, not just over the election, but really I would say for the last sort of 1 to 2 years. And really I think it distracts us from the really important issues, and that's about Tasmanians themselves. We are seeing a significant investment in an infrastructure project that will put us into debt for many years to come. We really want to see the incoming government consider Tasmanians, to invest in their well-being and really start to bring about some improved outcomes for Tasmanians over the medium to long term.
And also, Tasmania is quite spread out beyond Hobart. There are a lot of towns, a lot of regions to service. What are the difficulties facing the regions of Tasmania?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the whole of Tasmania is a regional area, and we actually have some of the worst outcomes in the country. You know, we consistently hear that we are the oldest, sickest, poorest state in the country. And I think that really it's just not good enough that we will accept that. I think that we can do better, and that we really need to see a government that has some aspiration, shows some leadership and really invests in people and their well-being, because that's the most important thing. And really we can't have a healthy economy unless we have healthy people who can participate.
And you mentioned better communication between NGOs like yourself and the government in the future. What sort of things, what sort of programs do you want to see them commit to?
Look, I think that we haven't seen commitment really to community services for some time now. Historically, that community services are sort of a bit undervalued and certainly under-resourced. You know, we saw during COVID that community services were really stepped up. Like, we were the organisations that were out there on the ground making sure people had what they need and keeping people safe. Community services are absolutely essential services. We're on the ground every day making sure Tasmanians have what they need. We're stopping people reaching that sort of acute or critical care need, and so that they don't end up at the emergency department. You know, community services are about right across the community. They're in alcohol and other drugs, in housing, you know, community health and volunteering. They're really ensuring that Tasmanians have what they need where and when they need it. And we really need to see a significant investment in our services, but it's also about the partnership agreement. I think this is the other thing that we really need to focus on, because to me that's a real sort of articulation or a commitment to how we'll work together, how we'll collaborate with mutual respect.
CEO of the Tasmanian Council of Social Services, Adrian Piccone there, speaking with Community Radio Network's Noah Secomb.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
A new report from the University of Melbourne's Fair Days Work Project has revealed widespread underpayment among young workers. One in three respondents earned $15 an hour or less, and nearly half reported working unpaid overtime. Just last week, there was a $5.5 million back pay settlement for regional supermarket workers, highlighting how common these breaches are. The settlement followed years of misclassification and unpaid entitlements, with more than 500 IGA workers across regional South Australia finally receiving compensation for wages they were legally owed. The Wire's Jordan Zarella spoke to Shop Distributive and Allied Employees Association spokesperson Jordan Mumford to find out more.
We were really pleased to secure that $5.5 million back pay for those workers located in regional South Australian retail stores. And a number of those workers had been seeking back pay for a number of years. And it was really pleasing to work constructively with the employer, who had identified through the work of the union a number of issues relating to allowances, classifications and various other underpayments, which we've obviously now been able to resolve and see those workers back paid. And I think what it highlights is there is challenges, particularly in retail and fast food, with non-compliance with industrial instruments.
In a media release on this, the SEA said that if these workers hadn't come forward, these systematic underpayments would likely still be happening. What does that tell us about the gaps in enforcement and the barriers for young workers?
Yeah, of course, we have the Fair Work Ombudsman, which is effectively the cop on the beat of industrial enforcement in Australia. And we know that they have limited resources, but also they often act on information that's been provided to them. And so when workers aren't coming forwards, or even in scenarios where there's resource limitations on the part of the Ombudsman, many occasions these issues are unresolved.
And just lastly, the Fair Days Work report found 38% of young workers had been underpaid and 24% missed out on compulsory super. What do these figures reveal about the state of youth exploitation today?
We do have a system in this country which does see, in the union's view, discrimination against young workers on the basis of age, and particularly in relation to junior rates of pay and the non-payment of superannuation for under 18s, for those who don't work 30 hours a week or more. We saw just in the last year over 500,000 Australian workers miss out on superannuation because they don't work 30 hours a week. And it's bad enough that workers aren't receiving the super they're actually entitled to, in some instances getting a 30% discount on their wages, which is currently lawful. That's currently what is allowed in this country on the basis of their age. We're not only seeking an outcome for those workers impacted, but also penalties, fines for those employers, to actually send a signal to the rest of the market that it's completely unacceptable to underpay.
Speaking with Professor John Howe, a labour law expert at Melbourne Law School, he says exploitation of young workers is multifaceted and often goes unchecked, largely because they're less likely to speak up or recognise when it's happening.
We found in the survey that underpayment's rife among young workers. So a third of the workers we surveyed were getting paid $15 or less in their lowest paid job. But we also found that exploitation was multifaceted. People were not getting paid super. They weren't being allowed to take breaks, not getting paid when they did additional or higher duties, getting paid in food or products. So I think there also needs to be more about the wider range of employment entitlements that workers have. Already we have the Fair Worksman that does prioritise young workers and does quite a bit of that educational activity and unions as well. But we found in the study that only about half of the workers who knew or thought they might have been underpaid or otherwise exploited went to those agencies or to their unions.
I just want to bring back to this case. It was announced last week that over 500 regional supermarket workers are being back paid $5.5 million after years of unpaid entitlements. From your perspective, what does this case expose about the limitations of the current enforcement systems?
What we're seeing is a lot of emphasis placed in the system on increasing penalties. So when it comes to deliberate underpayment or even underpayment by mistake, there are high penalties now under the Fair Work Act for that. But if, particularly in the case of deliberate underpayment, if employers think they can get away with it, they're going to keep doing it. So what we really need to do is increase the likelihood of detection. So change that perception among those employers that are deliberately doing this to actually think, okay, I might or I'm likely to get caught if I do this, and have them change that mindset. There's a lot of potential for data science tools to use existing labour market data to find where exploitation's occurring, even if those workers are not complaining. So I think something we should really be looking at closely.
The Wire's Jordan Cirella with that report. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Eduardo Jordan in Brisbane. A big hello to our friends in Alice Springs on ACCC, to our listeners in Hobart on Print Radio Tasmania, and to the other side of the country, to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. A new report released today shows the end of native forest logging in Victoria is helping 34 threatened species to keep their habitats. It's the first research quantifying the benefits of banning this practice in the state, which started in January 2024. However, not everything is positive, as there are challenges facing Victorian forests, and some other states like New South Wales are getting worse with logging. I started asking threatened species and climate adaptation ecologist at WWF, Dr. Kira Ashman, to explain more about the research.
Myself and my colleagues, we basically wanted to have a look at quantifying what the positive impact was of the Victorian government deciding to end native forest logging. And so we did a spatial analysis that basically looked at where the logging was planned for the next kind of 4 or 5 years, because that's kind of the time frames that logging is approved on, and where that overlapped with threatened species. And basically we found that most, if not all of the areas, it was like 99% of all of the areas that were approved to be logged over the next few years would have been federally listed threatened species habitat. So the fact that the government, you know, had decided to end native forest logging, it was several years earlier than what their kind of policy commitments were, just, you know, highlighting that it's such a great thing for threatened species and that it's a really good thing for biodiversity and climate resilience.
Now, what are the main benefits that has been seen in Victoria since this ban was introduced in 2024?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think it's been a little unclear in terms of the real, like, large impact or the big kind of benefits at this stage. There's been a lot of kind of back and forth between policy and kind of politicians and people that were formerly in the industry and lobbying groups that are kind of trying to reinstate logging in a lot of forests. So we're yet to see any major kind of positive impacts of this decision beyond, you know, the forest not being logged. That's obviously an amazing thing for threatened species. But in terms of funding for restoration or establishing new protected areas, it kind of feels like the government's been dragging their feet on a lot of those things and really hasn't taken this opportunity to really see through some really big impacts and really positive steps for threatened species and for biodiversity. So I think there's still a lot of work to be done. We're only kind of 12 months down the line, but I'm becoming more and more nervous that logging could be something that's resumed in Victoria because it hasn't been something that's locked into policy and legislation.
Now, in a nutshell, could you please tell us what about the Victoria's Timber Release Plan and what did the research find about the plan and the habitats of species?
So timber release plans are usually kind of approved for several years at a time. And so what we basically found in a nutshell is that all of the areas, almost all of the areas, 99% of the areas that were approved in the timber release plan were also really important threatened species habitat. And some of the species like leadbeater's possums are critically endangered. And so they had a pretty large overlap among other species like bauble frogs, as some plant species. It was quite diverse, the species that would be most impacted by that logging. So the fact that, you know, native forest logging at the industrial scale has been ended is really positive for these species, but it really needs to be followed up by restoration protection.
Okay, and what are some of the challenges these forests will face in the future for Victoria?
Yeah, it's a good question. These forests have been kind of really heavily hit by logging and bushfires over the last kind of, you know, 50 to 100 years. It's really been death by a thousand cuts for a lot of these forests. And so going forward, what we see across a lot of Victoria's forests is that a lot of the forest area is quite young, which means because it's been logged or burned previously, there's very few patches of old mature forest that's remaining. And so when we have young forest, it's much more likely to burn. It isn't able to sequester and store as much carbon as some of those older forests. A lot of the benefits of forests are really only kind of coming online as they get older. And so it just means that forests across Victoria are a little bit at risk in a warming climate, and it certainly doesn't help biodiversity to kind of persist through that time as well. So really, there's some important areas that benefit from this, but the struggles are basically going to be stopping logging from continuing in other forms, stopping logging from starting back up in future years.
The study showing benefits, also, you know, you have your doubts on all that. And it's been a very short time period of this research for ending native logging in Victoria. But what would you like to see in other states like New South Wales to happen?
This study highlights the benefits of ending native forest logging. You know, obviously, we haven't seen all of those benefits play out, and we've still got a long way to go in terms of putting funding towards good forest restoration programs, protecting areas, making sure that First Nations groups are able to kind of have self-determination of forests. And so I think highlighting what it can do to end native forest logging for those species and those groups just shows how much this needs to happen in other states. So New South Wales is a perfect example where the industry is hemorrhaging money, it's destroying country and people's ability to kind of connect with country and forest, it's greatly impacting the biodiversity and climate crisis. So it's absolutely time for that industry to be wrapped up in places like New South Wales. Tasmania is another great example.
That was threatened species and climate adaptation ecologist at WWF, Dr. Kira Ashman. This week, the Anti-Emergency Service celebrates its 50th anniversary, and they look into bringing the community together across the territory. The first Anti-ES Open Day will be held in Tennant Creek, bringing activities for families and an overview of the organization's rich history, including the vital role Anti-ES had in the evacuation of 10,000 Territorians following Cyclone Tracy in 1974. To chat more about the event and the importance of the service, The Wire's contributor from ACCC, Shauna Upton, started asking Anti-Emergency Service Manager Southern Command, Ian Carlton, what's in plan to celebrate the milestone?
Yes, that was part of our 50th anniversary celebrations. And as you said earlier, we're opening the doors across the territory, inviting public to get a glimpse of behind the scenes of the Northern Territory Emergency Service, especially our Tennant Creek. So it's our Tennant Creek Volunteer Unit Open Day this weekend, and it's the first of the open days from 10 a.m. And it's an opportunity to find out more about Northern Territory Emergency Service in the region, especially that Barkly. So our Tennant Creek Volunteer Unit cover right across the Barkly region and go through and learn some of the info that, or the equipment they've got, what they've done over the years. So they've been going about since the mid-60s, and were quite involved in Cyclone Tracy response.
Now, just to be really clear, Ian, is it the 50th anniversary of the NTES in the Barkly or in the territory as a whole?
In the territory. So the Northern Territory Emergency Service, there was civil defence that came out after World War II when, and a lot of the actions. And then nationally that changed to emergency services or state emergency service. Northern Territory Emergency Service started in early January after Cyclone Tracy in January 1975.
I was just going to say, did that start as a response to Cyclone Tracy?
Yeah, so there was the civil defence. And then came across to Northern Territory Emergency Service and going through. But prior to that, there was civil defence and quite active in that Tennant Creek area.
Right, so are people going to be able to learn a little bit more about that part of the history of the NTES? There's going to be a bit more to discover about that on Saturday?
There certainly is. And also now people can go and see the National Trust Museum in Tennant Creek that has a great display from about the emergency services, so both police, fire, and the Northern Territory Emergency Service in one of the rooms, and it does go through and talks about the story of NTES and Tennant Creek and what not just the emergency services, but the whole of Tennant Creek, what they did for the people that evacuated Darwin. Like some 10,000 people came through Tennant Creek in early 75, getting out of Darwin and away from Cyclone Tracy. They were registered, fed, car serviced.
Yeah, it's crazy to think.
Housed overnight while they travelled on further.
Yeah, when you look at how, like, the size of Tennant today, and obviously, you know, that's 10,000 people on top of the existing residents. So NTES, what does that umbrella term sort of cover? You know, I feel like sometimes people lack a bit of clarity about what that actually means. They might think that it's just like the SES, for example.
Yeah, so we are the Hazard Management Authority for flood, storm, earthquake, cyclone, storm and water damage, land search. So it's not just going through on a small amount. We do large amount, and our volunteers in Tennant Creek do quite a lot of that work. You'll see them out and about in their orange and in their vehicles. They're based up at Leichhardt Street in Tennant Creek. And as I said earlier, they cover that whole of that Barkly region. They go across. They've done aerial searches, land searches for missing persons out on the Barkly through there, assisted with the flooding when the Barkly Highway and the tablelands through there experienced flooding. Earthquake, they do urban search and rescue. So in the event of, and as we know, we've had quite a few earthquakes in and around that Tennant Creek area. Mm. So if there was a larger earthquake and building damage, we would work with other emergency service organisations, undertake that urban search and rescue, or USAR, as it's commonly known as, which is, and for us, it would be that line and hail on top of debris, removing victims that are visible, and then other emergency services would come in and go into the collapsed buildings and look for and rescue people. Those Tennant Creek volunteers, they're not just stuck into their area. They can be moved around, and the same as all our volunteers, where we support our southern volunteers go to Darwin at times and support Darwin and the northern region in larger events. Volunteers have been to Queensland. We had a volunteer from Tennant Creek back many, many years ago as an air observer searching for MH370 off the West Australian coastline. So there's lots of varied work that people can do. And as we've said, with the open day, there'll be chainsaw demonstrations, other equipment demonstrations, talking what we do, seeing some photos and the history of what we do, how to get involved, what you can learn as a volunteer as well, and keep putting back to your community.
That was Ian Carlton from the NT Emergency Service speaking with ACCC's Shona Opton. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for listening wherever you're in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Melbourne and Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Turrbal and Jagera countries where this program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present, and emerging. I'm Eduardo Jordan from Radio 4EB in Mianjin, Brisbane. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.